Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, friends in cyberspace and internet land. You have tuned in to the Hushmo Black Forum. Again, welcome. This is our third show. So, I am the Hushmo, Hushmo Black. I'm the host of the Hushmo Black Forum here. I look like we're trying to get the phone system set up right. And our topic last week, first of all, I want to say this is the last weekend in Black History Month. Still want to pay homage to all of the Americans of African descent for this their month. How they still a kind of a puzzle as to how they got this month, but we'll take it. Whatever we can get, we'll surely take it. This being the last month of February, we're gonna do tonight. First of all, we'll just start out. I'll let you know. The Hushmo Black Forum is a social activist network. We advocate for social justice in our community, and we are part of the African-American community, but we love everybody. We just, we're part of that community, so we advocate on their behalf, much like other groups advocate on behalf of their constituents. We're here for our community, more or less, and we will be wherever we find injustice, though, we're going to be a voice for justice wherever we may find the injustice at. So we're going to get that. We do a lot of things on the Hushmo Black Forum. Here are the first couple of shows there. We've just been breaking down, this being Black History Month, we've been taking a look at some of our black leaders and heroes. And for me, it was W.E.B. Du Bois. We did him last week and had a great time with that. Still, I guess we touched over about, I don't even know, one... not even a tenth of the guy's life, but like I said last week, we're going to be coming back to W.E.B. Du Bois from time to time in every show for the next, I don't know how long, we're going to be mentioning something about him. Tonight, After we get into the show a bit, we're going to get into our first book review. And I thought about several books, but this being Black History Month, and we're going to do The Water Boy. We're going to take a look at The Water Boy, The Life and Trials of Jimmy C. Cameron, tonight's fairly new book. It's been out about 8 months now. It's our book, as a matter of fact. I am Hushmo Black, but I am an author, and my given name is Jimmy C. Cameron, so it is my book. But this being Black History Month, me being American of African descent, I thought it was apropos that we take a look at my book first, this being the first of your own. So we're going to take a look at that tonight. A little later on, we're going to just cover a few things here. First of all, you can call in. We invited some readers of the book, some folks that supported The Water Boy, and to come on and share with us and add some insight into the book. So you can call as we go along and get into that. I'm going to give you the number. The number is 310-742-1899. You can call there. That should be a free number. Call in there and chat with us if you so desire. Blog Talk Radio. We've been out here on Blog Talk Radio now for about 3 years. We first joined it about 2008, I guess. Never really did much with it, but we did get out there for a while to test it out. But it seems to me that the medium is exploding at this time, and just about everybody is out on in cyberspace somewhere. So we're excited to be a part of that explosion here. Looked like it's just the very tip of the iceberg, and have a chance to, from what I can see, of replacing talk radio. You know, I've always been curious about talk radio from, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. Got started listening to Rush Limbaugh and all of the conservative talk shows, and thought it was a powerful a medium to spread your message. And now with the advent of Blog Talk Radio and the internet, it's fairly simple to get into. I mean, it calls, and by the way, we will be this is not a non-profit show here, so we are going to be selling commercial spots on this show going forward. Tonight we won't be, but in the coming weeks and months ahead, as we grow, we're going to be adding sponsors to our show to help support us. We're not looking for anything big, but we do have several sponsors looking at offering their support to us. So going forward, we will be taking a breaks in the show about every 15 to 20 minutes, depending on how time goes. Right now it's about 10 after 7, but about 10 to 15 minutes into the show, we'll take a break just to catch our breath and clean up a few things. And as we add sponsors, we'll be taking routine breaks to or schedule breaks, not to get their business done and to try to pay the bills around here. We are a grassroots organization. The Hushmo Black Forum is definitely grassroots, and at this time, we're so grassroots. We got about one blade of grass up in here, and that's me. But hopefully, we're going to expand that as time go on. As well as expand the listening audience, we've got a number of guests scheduled for the coming shows next week. We're going to have we're going to be taking a look at Conservative Talk Radio and dynamics of that enterprise and how it's driving the frenzy in the country. And we're going to be having guests on to kind of see if we can digest that and to see if we can make sense of it all, the Tea Party is and all the rest. we're going to be taking a look at to see just how it's affecting our community and how best we need to respond to it. I was saying in my first show that, you know, we've got great national leaders and the Al Sharptons and the Tavis Smileys and just on and on great leaders. But I think it's so important for our community to get a wide range of input from throughout the community, from the grassroots level on up to the national leaders there. We need to get a broad perspective of just what it is that's on our mind and see if we can't participate. In fact, we have to participate in this conversation that's going on in the country today, because I for one find it troubling. And so I think it behooves us as a community to get all the input that we can into this conversation. And that's one of the reasons that Hushmobile Black is out here tonight trying to add our two cents into that conversation. We're going to take a short break and see if we can get someone on the line here pretty soon to, just to test our systems out. But then we're going to be coming back doing introducing you to the Water Boy, the life and trial of Jimmy C. Cameron. It is my first book, although I'm in the middle of the second edition of the Water Boy and just about finishing up on my second book, White Racism, Black Hate, and American Reality, which will be out in approximately, I guess, about a month and a half from now. We should have that out in a fascinating story. Those two things we'll be having in the works for you. That's the second edition of The Water Boy and my second book. Now, we're going to take a break, and we should be back in a couple of minutes, and then we're going to jump into The Water Boy, and hopefully you'll enjoy the insight into it from the author himself, me, and we're going to break it down for you. And so hang tight, and if you want to get online, just dial into 310-742-1899. We got a Skype, the Skype thing, but someone tried to call into that number and it just kind of blew up there. So you might want to just, until we find out what's going on with the Skype call in, just use the 310-742-1899. And we'll get the Skype fixed as we go along tonight. But then at 7:18, we're going to take our first break here, and we'll be back shortly to get into The Water Boy. We're back. That's Free Your Mind, by the way. This is the intro song for us. Joe Sample, Free Your Mind. Just a classic piece that we fell in love with some time back. And just that whole thing just captures what I'm about, freeing your mind. We're going to... Normally on the Hushmobile Black Forum, what we do is the first part of the show, too, by the way, we cover current events and whatever, Zen the News. But the only thing that's so much is in the news, but the on an international level, that thing in the Middle East is just blowing up like crazy. First Egypt, then Tunisia, then Libya is boiling, and Gaddafi is on the run and fighting back, and that whole situation over there is just crazy. It's mind-boggling to sit back and watch what's going on in the Middle East there with the democracy. We don't really know whether democracy is breaking out or not until some new governments are established, but surely appears as though democracy is breaking out. If by definition, democracy is chaos, and from the ground up, look like that's what we've got going on over there. But it could be good, but we just don't know until all this stuff shakes down, I guess. I still contend that if any kind of democracy is of any note set up over there, the president, President Obama, has to get a lot of credit for that because of the speech that he made in Cairo back in 2009 at the University of Cairo, telling the students over there how great that democracy was, and everybody should have access equally to it. And that, I think, was a... impetus in a lot of ways to what's going on today. That's the Middle East. Of course, we got the union folks up in Wisconsin, the governor up there trying to, I guess, be a Ronald Reagan to just break a union for whatever reason. But to say that... he's a Reagan Republican. I don't know. It seems to me to be crazy what's going on in Wisconsin and some of the other states now controlled by the Republicans. I don't know. We'll have to see how that plays out. But enough of that. Enough of the current events now, because the show is about the water boy, the life and trials of Jimmy C. Cameron. I am the author of that book, so... We self-published the book. First of all, when you self-publish a book, you have to get out there and create the marketing for yourself, pretty much. It's all on you. You do it any way you can, you know, but book shows, selling it out your trunk if necessary. Have done some of that, but it's selling pretty good for a self-published piece of work. We have it in you can get it online, by the way, any bookstore, Barnes & Noble's, Amazon.com. Here locally in Atlanta, where we're located at, you can find it at Madhu Bookstores. That's Madhu Book Store is located at Greenbrier, in the Greenbrier Mall, Southwest Atlanta, if you're familiar with the area there. Yeah, stop by and check us out in there. The Water Boy, give you a little background on it. I started writing here about 4 years ago. I retired from the computer industry, worked some 40 years in the computer industry, retired in 2007 mainly, just... body started breaking down from old war wounds and things like that, and I decided I need to take a break at work. I guess all my life, some 40-something years in the computer industry, and prior to that was in the service. So I've worked since I was 18. So I retired, and I found myself sitting around the house all day on the internet. Think I would have been able to find something else to do after working 40 years in the computer industry than to sit around on the internet 4 or 5 hours a day. But I really, I've been messing around with the internet since its inception. So it was a natural thing for me. And I really, today I'm still on that 4 or 5 hours a day. I mean, just, yeah, I don't know, researching my books and whatever. But then in 2007, when I retired, I came to the conclusion that I really needed to find something else to do. And I thought about, it'd be nice if I could write me a book or kind of document my history or my family's history. Really, I started out an autobiography. I wanted to kind of just know one of my family, you know, that I know real close, had written a book about me or my family or anyone else. So I said, dog, maybe that's something I need to do. I'm getting old, and my daughter's a writer. I got two daughters. One of them's a really good writer. She's an attorney. And I said, well, dog, I'm going to write an autobiography. She said, well, Dad, since you're going to do that, you might as well write about your family. I said, well, dog, that's a good idea. My family history go back some 200 years here in Georgia. So I said, well, yeah, that I'll just include that. So I this is 2007. I don't know anything about writing. I've never written a short story, a no story, anything, you know, of note up until then. I said, well, dog, I need to take some kind of a writing course, a continuing education course. And just what happened, she was going to Emory out there at some writing class, and she told me, it'll be a good class for you to take. It's about 5 weeks, five things, creative writing course. That's what I signed up, and sure enough, got in the class there, and Julius Thompson was the instructor, a great author, by the way. This new book, Ghost of Atlanta, is a fast-selling a new novel that's on the market now. Just hit the market. You probably heard of it. You'll be hearing more from him. Julius Thompson wrote a trilogy. Started out with Brownstone in Brooklyn, then went to Philly Style, Philly Profile, and then the third one is The Ghost of Atlanta, which just was released here in the last couple of 3 weeks. Julius Thompson was the instructor of that class, and really gave me just the basics of how you construct a book or a novel or so I went from there. I mean, it's not I'm not any kind of major writer, that's for sure. But I really enjoy putting my history down in writing. It's something about it. I mean, I urge everyone to research their family history and just put it down. It you get so much enjoyment out of it. Just the research alone just threw me way back in time. It threw me. So anyway, I started writing. I started out an autobiography, and then quickly it turned into a biography of my family's history in Georgia, going stretching back to the late 1700s, really. So I started writing there, and then I quickly get a part of my life in Vietnam there, where I had this little where I got wounded. I was over there for the better part of a year, and got wounded over there, and had this little spiritual epiphany, I like to call it, and people look at me kind of funny when I say that, but that, I got to that part of my life, and that kind of took over the book, the story in the book, that incident. So what I had going, I said, dog, I've got three different stories going here. I've got a autobiography, sort of, and I got a biography, sort of, and now I got this spiritual epiphany thing there, where I had this run-in with the man upstairs, Almighty God himself, and that kind of took over the story of the water boy. And however, I was left in the other two parts that became just props for that main protagonist, I guess, if you want to put it that way, of the story, of my story. So I started writing, doing all the research on my family's history and stuff, which, like I said, was fun, but was kind of easy for me. Because if you go to my website, hushmoblack.com, the picture of the book is there. I'm not streaming live yet. I will be in the coming days, too. We will have a live stream, video stream running to my website. But right now we don't have that hooked up yet. And, but the book is on my website, and you can kind of see I've got four digital images on the front cover. I kind of embedded some, like this, allegories in the digital images there to kind of tell a story. Surely I couldn't get 2 years of history of my family life here in Georgia in a 200-page book. I tried to tell some of their stories, some of my family's history, in the allegories embedded in the digital images on the front of the book. Okay, I just did that before you open the book, kind of get a glimpse of what's going on with my family. Starting on the left bottom there was my great-great-granddaddy's 1870 census. Now, like I said, I'm from Georgia. I was born here in 1945, so it wasn't that difficult for me to get back to 1870, my relatives, because I knew some of my grandparents and things like that. I was born in 1945 in Henry County, Georgia. Most of my family, my father's family, is from Troup County. That's LaGrange, Georgia, and just about all the Camerons. I won't say all of them, because some of them claim not to be any part of that family, but most of the Camerons are from Troup County are somehow related to my great-great-granddaddy, Dan Cameron. It's pretty hard to get around his tree or his shadow from 1870. I got him going back to 18. He was born in 1820, Dan Cameron was, but like I said, I picked him up. That was my great-great-grandfather. I picked him up on the census in the 1870 census, the first time Americans of African descent here in Georgia had their name on a legal on a census document. That was 1870 census, the most Americans of African descent doing genealogy research. One of the places that they get to very quickly is that 1870 census. And sure enough, I did as well. But then it was easy for me to do, like I said, because I've been here most of my life here in Georgia, and we've been around here 200 years. So, but just going down to the archives, the state archives, the federal archives, I could do most of the research there, but then I still got relatives in LaGrange, in Henry County, so and Griffin, all down through there. So I touched bases with them and kind of got the genealogy straight. And that was interesting, though. It took me about 2.5 years to really just to get all that down, to get it straight, so that it would be accurate and so forth. So I started out writing about that. got back to on my father's side. Now, my mother's side, my mother was born in Tuskegee, Alabama. I mean, but her mother was born right here in Atlanta. In 1896, she was born right here in Atlanta. Bessie Mae Riles was my grandmother, and I knew her. She lived with us quite a while in my adolescent years, and my mother's family on her mother's side is from right here in Atlanta, Georgia. There, they go back to the 1800s here in Atlanta. So you could say both my mother's folks and my father's folks are from Georgia. We indigenous folks been here longer than most families are in this area, so we are indigenous to Georgia as far as that goes. If 200 years make you indigenous, we are indigenous to Georgia. This is what we claim. But on my father's side, I go back five generations there through myself, through my father Ben, through his father Andrew, through Andrew's father William, to Dan Cameron back in 1870 census, and then my father's mother, Alice Delaney, was my father's mother. Then her father, Dave Delaney, to his father, Robert Delaney, also on the 1870 census. So I got both of my great-great-grand parents, my paternal grandparents. On my father's side, five generations of them, straight back to 1870. And I stopped. I didn't really stop there. Well, I know the slave owners who owned Dan Cameron. The unique thing about Dan Cameron and Robert Delaney, they were both slaves and free. They lived through the Civil War. That's an interesting a person when you look at them. They in 1870, the Civil War, like 5 years old, well, behind them. Yet they had lived the vast majority of their lives in slavery. And but to be free there, to see their names on the census for the first time, I tried to capture that excitement from coming into freedom like that. Must have been akin to the Israelites coming up out of Egypt, in a sense. Just a exciting time for them, yet filled with the horrors of what was to follow in freedom. Slavery was for sure man's worst inhumanity to man. But then, after Dan and my great great grandfather Robert. Were free. They still overjoyed with freedom, yet that joy was circumvented by the just the political purgatory that they found themselves in for the rest of their lives. I mean, they. Dan died in 1880. He checked out, and then Robert died shortly thereafter. But they found themselves caught up in this political purgatory that the rest of the free Americans of African descent. Experience, especially here in the South, with the separate but equal laws and things of that nature that really kept them second-class citizens. I hate to use that word, but they're second-class citizens. I detest that. that term, but for a lack of a better word, we'll just say it kept the separate but equal thing kept us certainly at a disadvantage in that it stripped away our 14th Amendment rights for some 90 years, I guess, after 1865, the separate equal and the other Jim Crow laws and the segregation and all that stuff really took away our 14th Amendment rights that put us so far behind just about in every category in the society that it was it made it impossible for us to achieve any kind of equality in terms of any financial equality or social equality, anything else with the racism and the bigotry and stuff that we encountered. My father from Dan, though, just getting back to Dan. Dan Cameron, Dan had some 10 kids after 1850. After 1850, he had like 10 kids. The youngest on the 1870 census was William Cameron. Of all of his kids, William was the youngest in 1870 on that census. Well, William was my father's grandfather. He was born like in 1886, so he was 4 years old. And by the way, the only child that Dan Cameron had that wasn't a slave. He was born in 1866, about a year after the Civil War was over, okay? And then on Robert Delaney's side, that chart come down to Dave Delaney. He was the youngest one on that 1870 census out of Robert's Delaney's family. So Dave Delaney, by the way, was my father's mother's father. So that's my father's grandfather on his mother's side. Those two families, by the way, tell you a little something about the Dan Cameron and Robert Delaney's families. In doing my research, I discovered that those two families, they intermarried for generations, both before 1865 and after 1865, on up until the 1940s. Those two families intermarried and produced kids down there in Troop County and throughout that part of Georgia, from Troop County to Griffin to Hampton to just about all the way to Atlanta. But they produced more kids. I made the comment they probably produced more slaves in Troop County than any two families down there. And but just a fascinating family going forward from Dave Delaney and William Cameron. They produced my father's parents, Andrew Cameron and Alice Delaney. Andrew Cameron, by the way, is my grandfather. Had kids by two sisters there, Alice and Rose Delaney, and my father was one of his offsprings by Alice Delaney, and sure enough, that was quite a rift in my family's history there. But back in those days, it seemed that with the pressures to bear kids for the cotton fields and so on, it wasn't that big of a deal, but it did cause an uproar in my family, and I kind of shed light on that in the book. It kind of covers that take us to 1910. My father, Ben Cameron, was born in 1910 in LaGrange, Georgia. Textile town, LaGrange was pretty much one of the biggest textile areas around there, with the West Point Paper Reel and all that stuff falls within that area. So after the Civil War, my family stayed there. They stayed there in Troop County, I guess, for the next 20 years with very little movement outside of that county until the cotton fields, you know, start to slacken up, and they the newly freed Americans was seeking bigger and better things, and they started slowly migrating outside of Troop County, heading north. Well, heading to Atlanta, really, but they made several stops on the way, like Henry and Griffin, and sure enough, by 1920, my father Ben had moved to Henry County from LaGrange, which it's not that far. Maybe I said it must be about 40, 45 miles at that, straight up the highway there. And there is where he started a family. 1920, he's some 10 years old. He moves to Hampton, Georgia with his grandfather, Dave Delaney. And there, sure enough, in Hampton, Georgia, he meets my mother, Olamea Johnson, who was living there at the time because, like I said, her mother, Bessie, was born in Georgia, but her father, Elijah Johnson, was born in Alabama, and somehow he had came to Atlanta and met my mother's mother there, and they got married. In fact, moved back. My grandmother moved back to Alabama with him. It's where my mother was born, Chambers County, Alabama. It's right outside of Tuskegee. Actually, she was born in Chambers County, Alabama. So, sure enough, though, but by 1920, they had moved to Hampton, too. Now, completely two different families there, the Johnsons and the Delaneys and Camerons on one side, and the Johnsons was on the other side, and my father and my mother hooked up around 1930. They got married. And started a family, and from that union, some 10 kids, 10 siblings. I had 9 sisters and brothers out of that union, Ola Mae and Ben Cameron, the oldest being Woodrow, born in 1932. And along come Curtis, 1933, and Curtis, my second to the oldest brother, died of meningitis before he reached 2, mainly because of lack of access to medical care back then. I mean, it was almost non-existence for people sharecropping and stuff like that, trying to get medical proper medical care down in Hampton, Georgia. I think someone doctor in the whole town. Then my mother wound up walking some 5, 6, 7, 8 miles a day. Well, one way to take my brother to trying to get my brother to the doctor to, that didn't work out. He wound up dying of meningitis there as a baby. But then came Harvey in 1935, and my sister Alice in 1936. And as you can see, my mother was just pumping kids out there, just stair steps one after another there until she got to 10. I come along and, my brother Charlie in 1938, my sister Robbie in 1940, Ben in 1943, 1945, I come out the seventh. the eighth child. Then my sister Ann in 1947, my brother in 1950. Concludes my aunt's siblings. I come along in 1945, though. Born in Hampton, Georgia, and I tell a story. I was born right there in Henry County in 1945 in the middle of a cotton field. And people don't believe that, well, they look at me kind of funny and laugh, but that in reality is pretty much was the case. I was born right where there's a Nassau racetrack there today, big fancy racetrack there in Henry County. I was born within walking distance of that property in 1945. I stayed there in Hampton on the farm, sharecropping there for about until 1949, I guess, when we finally got up out of there. I have vivid a memory of a couple of those years, even 2 to 4 years old. I can remember distinctly specific events, especially, but more than that, like in 1948 when my grandfather died. That's an especial event. That's kind of ingrained in my mind because we wound up going to first time I've ever been in any kind of car, any kind of trip. Wound up driving to Opelika, Alabama, to his funeral, which was an all-day process back then. Now it took about an hour to get there, but back then it took some half a day, 6 hours, looked like, to drive from Hampton to Opelika, Alabama. And I remember that. That was one of those things that stuck out. There was other events, too, like being down there on that farm. A lot of folks was asking me where the war boy, what did that title come from? And I tell them, well, the short answer for that is that I'm an Aquarian, first of all, the water carrier, so it had something to do with that. But then as a youngster, I never did pick cotton, but I did sometimes carry water and accompany my older brother to the field and carry water for him while he was out there doing his chores or plowing the fields or whatever. So I did. I was a water boy in that respect, also. So, but then I contend as my life went on, and the water boy took on some other significance too. And I'll share that with you when we come back. I'm going to take a break right now. It is coming up on about just about 10 minutes till 8, and we're running a little long. I'm babbling at the mouth. Folks have accused me of being rather talkative, or having sometime a case of logorrhea. That's somebody who talked too much, by the way. But so if that's the case on a normal day, imagine how I would. How much I would get carried away talking about myself and my family's history. And so we're running a little late, but we're going to take another break right here. If anybody's out there listening, give us a call, 310-742-1899. We'll get you in the screening room and see if we can get you on the air. If you have any thing up to this point, we're just getting into the water boy. Let's see, we're up to 1945, my birth. Covering a real brief look at my family's history up to that point. We did talk about Dan and Robert Delaney and William and Jean Cameron and my father's mother, Alice. And so we just briefly skirted over them, but we haven't really taken a hard look at them yet, and we're all the way up to 1945 with My Birth, and we're going to, when we come back, we're going to be coming back and telling you a little more about My Birth and my time down in, on the farm there in Henry County between 1945 and 50, and share a little of that with you, how that period impacted my life for the rest of my life. And we'll be back with that shortly. I am the Hushmo. You are listening to the Hushmo Black Forum. We be back. Well, we're back with you, fans out there in Cyberland. I don't know. I spent some time in Ohio here just to get away from the water boy a little bit, and still have great friends and family still there, and just been watching their talking to them. My brother-in-law and my brother here—they've been inundated with snow this week, and. They're catching holy heck this winter. those folks, they're pretty used to that type of weather. But when you start hearing them complain about it, you know it's really bad. But I want to give a shout out to them, and hopefully I don't know what the groundhog saw this year, whether it's going to be six more weeks of winter or early spring for them, but let's hope that they will get an early spring and get up under the onslaught of bad weather they've been having. That's my friends in Ohio, around Akron and Barberton, Ohio. Shout out to them tonight from the Hushmill Black Forum. Hopefully we'll get a chance to get one of them to dial in to let us know what he think about the Hushmill Black Forum. As time goes by, we most definitely will bring him on. Back to the water boy. The book itself, now, I didn't cover this. The book itself has got about 17 chapters in it. I mean, the Gore, chapter one's a look back, and reconstruction is chapter two. Family crisis, I kind of accounted, told you a little bit about the family crisis, about my grandfather Gene, how he was somehow in cahoots with two sisters there, and how that played out. Well, I didn't tell you how it played out, but it caused quite a crisis. So that's chapter three. Then chapter four is a move to Henry County. That's the year 1920, when my father and his grandparents did move to Henry County out of LaGrange, and that started. In a real sense, that migration out of Troup County for the Camerons. Now, they've been there for generations and barely left that county for various reasons, because of the restriction on movements of slaves. And then even after that, it was hard to move, even after the people were free, for various reasons. But then around 1910, they did start, after that, they started slowly migrating out of that county, kind of venturing out, looking for work, and, you know, just a different environment, a better way of life, if you have it. Yeah, so chapter four, moved to Henry County when my father got out of LaGrange, then my birth in 1945, and we're there. 1945, I was born, and like I said, we'll go over that again, Henry County, Georgia, a time that just an awfully dark part of my family's history here in the South, when racism and bigotry and discrimination was so prevalent, so thick in the air, you could just about cut it with a knife. And back in 1945, it was a debilitating thing. Racism was. I mean, it, the air was just, you could feel it in the air. And then when you breathe it in, I mean, it seems as though it just went all the way to my very soul, you know, and then stayed there for generations after that, looked like, and until I just regurgitated up hate. I mean, it stayed there, and that the hate that was regurgitated up did come from, in at least in my case, from the racism that I experienced as a child there in Hampton, Georgia. It's one of those things that in my new book, I'm just on a tangent here, going to my new book, Black Hate, White Racism, Black Hate. Part of that black hate on my part came directly from that experience there in Hampton, Georgia. I tell a story about the KKK. the Ku Klux Klan are coming to pay my family a visit one night, the day of the night I'm 3 or 4 years old. But that event left me shaken and scarred for some 60 years. I was one of the haters that I now so detest and find that racism, both racism and hate, are equal sins under Almighty God. But then it took me 60 something years. It stayed with me 60 years. That's how deep the scar was from some of the injustices and the racism that we suffered here. I'll never forget 1951 when I started school in Henry County there. I would ride the school bus right past a new a white school all the way to McDonough to run down dilapidated school. And one of the things I pointed out, one of the simplest things that I realized, one of my first recollections of something being a little different about that ride past that white school, they had swings out in the playground there. Now, I don't know how fast they was, but they had metal swings out there where the kids were swinging on the thing there. And then when I got to the black school there at McDonough, we didn't have any swings. We had a heel that we used to slide down on cardboard, on a piece of cardboard. Put the piece of cardboard down and slide down the hill, and we thought that was great. But then I always kind of envied those metal swings that was at that white school there, and I realized that we didn't anywhere near have the same resources that the other kids had. And that was just one of my things that I rebelled against in years going forward. Even to this day, I look at it when I talk about a reparation, which I do talk about in this book, by the way. And a lot of folks look at this little book and say, oh, you cover a lot of stuff in this book right here. You got 17 chapters here. This book is not even 200 pages long, but you go all the way from your great great granddaddy's census in 1870 to the political divide, reparations to the first African-American president. But I point out that when I started writing this book, I was 62 years old, and a lot of things happened in my life. My life has been about a lot of things. Over 62 years just living, you encounter a lot of different events. And if you're writing about your history, you want to cover at least briefly cover the different parts and times of your life. So that's why, I mean, yeah, I could have just talked about my spiritual epiphany. I could have wrote the whole book about that, but then it wouldn't have been an autobiography. I wouldn't have been telling about just my family's history or me. It would have been just about that. And at 62, I wanted to include all, not any great detail, but, you know, enough to give to paint a somewhat of a picture of my life. And so it is all over the place. I mean, yeah, but it's life. Life is complicated itself. So there's a lot of different aspects to it, and no different with my book here. 1951, that first grade, after the first grade there, my father, sick of the, I think that night, I think it had to be 49 that the KKK came to my house. My father never felt the same about Georgia, which he loved. he never quite felt the same about this state. Sure enough, a couple of 3 years later, he followed my uncle, his uncle Doug, to Barberton, Ohio. And he stayed up there for about a year, and then he came back and got us. And by 1953, the whole family was in Barberton, Ohio, having left the red soil of Georgia for the north. Part of that migration, like so many other Americans of African descent, from the south, they was just sick of the just the plague, the conditions in which they live. Was heading north to get to the factories and stuff like that, out of the cotton fields. seemed like my family and sister was one continuous journey or evolution up that ladder. I kind of skipped over the 30s. If you go back to the cover of the book, look at the second picture from the left, starting with the census of my great-great-grandparents, go up, you'll see a sibling, a picture of my siblings back in the 30s and 40s there, the period I really call political purgatory there. That was during a time that era covered the 30s and the 40s and the Great Depression, by the way. We my father was young, just married there in 1930, and we're in the midst of the Depression. But as that period unfolded, I'm kind of going back a little bit now, because we had got to 1951, me in the first grade. But just I want to shed some light on the 30s, that period there between the 30s and the 50s. The Great Depression, my family got caught up in that. And as bad as that thing was, with up to 500-600 banks fell in a day, my family, being, well, most of the Americans of African descent in Georgia at that time on sharecropping, on farms, was at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of economic positioning. So the Depression found them at the very bottom. So they really, as bad as the Depression was, it didn't affect them but so much. And in fact, in retrospect, the Depression wound up being, as it turned out, in a strange way, a stepping stone for a lot of my family that was down in LaGrange and Troup County and Henry County picking cotton and doing whatever else they did on the farms back then. But that was the Depression, in a strange way, turned out to be a stepping stone. What happened around 1936, my father hooked up with his cousins and stuff. His uncle's name had migrated, from LaGrange first to Henry County. And my father's favorite uncle, Uncle Doug, the one he later followed to Ohio, had moved from Hampton to Atlanta. Okay, so they migrated to the big city, the traction of the bright lights got my uncle up there. So my father and his brothers and cousins, they all used to hitchhike up to Atlanta, walk up sometimes from Hampton to visit him and stuff. So sure enough, by the mid-30s, the WPA had set up shop. That's Roosevelt's program there for putting people back to work. And sure enough, they would come up to Atlanta, lead the cotton fields, and hook up with that WPA, and wound up, my father did, several of his brothers and cousins, wound up working with the WPA for some 3 years, I believe. They went from Atlanta, they would get in gangs, more or less, and I went up and worked on the Tennessee Valley Authority while they was building that dam there, hauling cement, digging ditches or whatever. And sure enough, it left them better off than picking cotton in the cotton fields. So they left the cotton fields and be gone for weeks, three, 4 weeks at a time, living in the little barracks or whatnot they threw up for them. And for the first time, had access to government employment. And really a step up. A lot of my family members from the 30s working with that WPA kept those followed those government jobs from Henry County to Atlanta all the way to D.C., Washington, D.C. And sure enough, part of my family wound up in D.C. in the 40s and stayed there for the rest of their lives and still there today. But it was that WPA and their access to government employment that took them out of the cotton fields and was really a step up. My father even learned how to lay bricks and became a brick mason, really. But he learned that trade, dealing with the WPA. So that was a step up for him. But sure enough, after the WPA work dried up, I think like 1939, he was back down in Hampton on the farm again, back to the same old ground again. He hadn't got broken away from it altogether yet. Then that was just a little about that. I want to shed some light on that depression. It wound up being somewhat of a step up in a strange, crazy way for a lot of my family. Getting on back to 1951 here, and 1952, 1953, when we migrated to Ohio. My father, like I said, he was up there for maybe a year or so before he came back and got the rest of us, my mother and the rest of my siblings, except my two older brothers went with him. They went with him. They was grown. They was pretty well not grown, but 17. You know, that was grown then. You get to be 17 this time. You don't be on your own. So my brother Woody and Harvey, they went to Ohio with my father. And so they came back and got us in 1953. We went up there and stayed that year. Sure enough, my brother Charlie had to Barberton, Ohio. Another strange world for me. I'm young. You know, I'm eight years old or something like that, and I get to Ohio and wind up in the second grade there with white kids. Scared me to death. Scared me to death. First time I ever seen been that close to white people, and really still had a real crazy feeling about them, you know, because I didn't know. I thought all white folks was evil, and I hated them. At least I thought I did at that time. And to be thrown in with them, it was kind of a. But I'm still a kid, so I'm still impressionable, and I quickly adapted to it. But even that. Even though Ohio, even though I went to school with white kids, and it seemed to be such a difference than the prejudice and the racism and stuff that I had experienced in the South, I found out as I developed a little knowledge about what was going on in the world, that even there in Ohio, racism existed there too, and maybe worse in some instances, but in a different type of way. You still had the folks from West Virginia and just the different the Polish American neighborhoods and the Irish over here. And, had a whole mixture of things in this little town I lived in. You got the black folks over here and the West Virginia folks over here, and they coexisted, but sure enough, we used to have some a great talent as kids, but the racism existed there too. And every once in a while, a black and a white would get in a fight, and you'd hear them yell out, there's a fight, it's a black and a white, and that type of thing. Thing through my childhood was let me know that even there, racism did exist in the North, just as it did in the South. But there, it also taught me that all white folks are not racist, and wound up meeting and keeping for life some good friends that were white, and so that's. We stayed there. It's 1953. I'm in the second grade with the white kids, and I got through that. But 1954 come along, and my brother Charlie, my brother closest to me, came down with rheumatic heart fever, and he passed away. He was died. He was like 15 to 16 years old there, and it upset my mother to no end. That did, and that kind of just drove her. She didn't want anything else to do with the North, and she quickly gathered up the rest of the kids that was, you know, still at home that wasn't on their own, and took us back to Atlanta. That next month or so, just like that too, and I wound up staying here, coming back here, going to the third grade. 1954, moved into Carver Homes here in Atlanta, and I never forget that my father and my mother separated then. They never did get a divorce. Now, they separated, but they never did get a divorce, and they always remained married, and he always took care of them. So that way, but that really divided our family there, and that was quite a traumatic experience for me and for the rest of my siblings. That experience they would have us living here in Georgia, another half living in Ohio. So I come back down here to the third grade, but then that next year, 1954, was a crazy year all together there. My brother Harvey by that time had went to the Marine Corps. By the way, he went to Marine Corps in 1951. Was in Korea when my brother Charlie died, and had to come home on leave there. Never forget that. And then kind of talk about that in the book. But then we get back down here, like I said, in 1954, and the Christmas that year, and it was kind of a crazy thing. You know, Christmas time is always a fun time. Kids open little gifts and stuff. They got roller skates and a lot of joy and laughter around in the household. But this particular Christmas of 1954, all my oldest sisters was crying, and my aunts, they were crying. I didn't know what was going on. And come to find out, Johnny Ace had died that Christmas day in 1954, and he was quite a old. Some of the older folks may appreciate Johnny Ace, but he was quite a ladies' man, and kind of broke a lot of ladies' hearts. And I always remember that he died on Christmas Day from I guess some kind of game of Russian roulette or something. At least rumor has it, and that broke a lot of my family female's heart. And that kind of stuck with me. But then the next year, I'm back in Ohio again with my father because it was a strain on my mother trying to take care of all the kids there. And I was getting on up in age in 1955, I'm 10 years old. So I'm really getting to the point where I can look out for myself. But anyway, I go back to Ohio to stay with my father and my two oldest brothers. Harvey was in the Marine Corps, and Woody was, you know, he was the only one at home with my father. So I go up there and have to repeat the third grade again because that I went to the third grade down here. For some reason, when you go up there, they make you repeat that grade again. Back then they did because I guess they don't think they teach you anything down here. So I wound up back in the third grade again up there, 1955, which was quite an experience. I remember that third grade class now because lot of those folks in that class were in Barberton there. I remained friends with for the rest of my life, including my best friend, a gentleman by the name of Paul Jackson. In fact, I married him. He introduced me later on to his cousin, who I married and I'm married to today. All came out of that third grade class in 1955. So that's I'm back in Ohio again on my own, pretty much, because my father's working and my older brother's working, and I'm going to school. You know, I'm pretty well on taking care of my or supervising myself, along with the community elders there, some dear friends of mine, Paul Jackson's mother for one, which wound up my mother, my wife's cousins, by the way. They're all cousins, Miss Jackson, Claudia Jackson, and Priscilla Parnell, and all those ladies used to watch me like I was their son, and really would discipline me if they caught me doing anything wrong, just like my mother would. So from that point, I did have some discipline and then going on. Like I said, my father's working all the time. My brother Woody, he's working. I'm left at the house most of the time by myself after school was out. And then in the summertime, it was, you know, just me and my friends. You know, so but then I was pretty disciplined at that time. I as a kid, I remember getting like whoopings. I mean, my father never whooped me. Never in his life did my father ever whip me or lay his hand on me. I mean, I didn't mess with him. I didn't mess with my father. My father wasn't one to be messing with. So I for one never did mess with him. I'm gonna take a break here right now. Look like we got somebody on the line there. We're gonna try to get them in, and let me take a real break here. Right now, we'll come back and continue this thing. We're up to 1955 here, with about an hour and a half to go. Let's see what the caller want online here. We'll be right back with you in about 3 minutes here. Just hold tight. You got the Hushbo Black on the Hushbo Black Forum here, taking a look at the Water Boy, the life and trials of Jimmy C. Cameron. We'll be right back with you here. Thank you. We're back on live here at the Hushbo Black Forum, and we do have our first caller this evening on. It's Brother Brock from Philadelphia there. He had a question for the author there. Brother Brock,
okay.
Go ahead and repeat your questions.
From Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, just as far as listening to the sojourn that your family took from the South, migrating up north, during the 1940s and 50s with mm-hmm. Arthur, how did the author wind up obtaining information for the book? Did you have to talk to the grandparents, the parents? Did you go to the library to get it off a microfilm because computers weren't around just then? So how did you have to absorb this information?
Okay, Brother Brock, that's a good question. Okay, now I'm the author, Jimmy C. Cameron here. I'm 66 years old. I just had a birthday here a couple of weeks ago, February the 4th. Okay, so I was born here, Brother Brock, in 1945. Okay, so I knew a lot of my grandparents. Believe it or not, when some of my grandparents were alive when I was, 4 or 5 years old, so I got to know I knew all my uncles and stuff like that. So my family's history was pretty easy for me to trace. Okay, up until my great grandfather William. The only person I didn't have at that time was his father. I pretty well knew about William. I never met William. He died long before I was born. But my grandfather Andrew Cameron and his family they all lived in LaGrange. So just about every time someone would die. After I moved out of Hampton, we'd go back to LaGrange, so I always kept in touch with that part of my family. So it wasn't that much of a ordeal for me to research my family's history here in Georgia. Although, where I went to get the information that I didn't have, I went to the Georgia Archives, and then they got a federal archives thing now. Went online to ancestry.com, provides an enormous amount of information on researching your family's history. But, I started out like I knew a lot of my old aunts and stuff like that and just talked to them about whose father. William Cameron now, no one could ever tell me exactly who his father was, because by the time I got into the research, but I quickly found it. Just going to the archives, and I could see who William's father was. So I got to Dan Cameron there in the 1870 census. But you do want to go to the archives, and they did have it on microfiche. Right now, a lot of that stuff is on. They converted over to ancestry.com, so it's on the internet, it's on the computer, and things like that. But initially, all of it was on microfiche there at the Georgia Archives is where I initially went. So, that's pretty much how I did that.
Okay, great. Thanks for the information, and I'll just keep listening in the background if you don't mind.
Oh, absolutely. I'll put you back in the background, and I appreciate the call in here.
All right, then. Keep up the great work.
All right. All right, that's Brother Brock on the line. He's still there listening in the background, and we're going to get back to the water boy here. We're up to pretty much 1955 there, talking about the third grade there. We went on in Washington Elementary School in Barberton, Ohio, is where I really got a lot of, believe it or not, my personality. when you 9, 10, 11 years old, you start kind of figure out what's going on in the world. But then I also started playing basketball and football in elementary school there in the fifth and sixth grade there, and got to be quite a athlete coming up through high school. But I started there in Washington Elementary School, 56. 1956 come along, and I'm just that summer sticks in my mind because I had this crazy experience with I kind of left out a lot of things too about my a take on the little adventures with a death. I always had a strange type of a relationship with death, whether it be my grandfather's or had an uncle that died. I always had some kind of a crazy reaction. Even when my brother Charlie died, I had some crazy reaction to that, where I would be fleeing things and all kinds of crazy stuff. But here come 1956, we were all up at Lake Anna there in Barberton at this Lake Anna was one of the favorite little gathering spots in the summer there for the kids. In fact, it was where I really learned how to swim. I'm 10, 11 years old there, but I learned how to swim, I think, the summer before, 1955. But then in 1956, we were back up there again, and Lake Anna was a pretty big lake. I don't know how deep they said it. It had an underground stream or something running for miles, emptying out into some other lake somewhere miles away, but we're up there swimming in Lake Inn there, and the thing was about a 2 mile radius lake there, and had a dock on one end where we used to go and sit. But then out in the middle of the lake, they had this buoy, and once you learn how to swim, you'd want to test your ability to swim out to the middle of that thing. There was quite a swim for a young kid, you know, to test your stamina, just how good you was. So we all out there one summer. It's beautiful in July. The weather's hot. The lake is packed, white and black. Everybody used to gather there. We didn't mix socially that much, but at Lake Inn, everybody used to be there because we all lived together and went to school together, and that was one of the places that we did socialize at Lake Anna there. So we all up there swimming, and Paul Jackson, like I said, my dear friend Paul, we're all swimming. Paul decided to swim out to the buoy. He takes off and go out there. And I've been out there once before. I had been out there once, and I said, "Well, dog, I'm gonna try it too." Paul took off, so I take off about 10 yards after him. I'm gonna swim out to the middle there. It's a pretty good swim. I'm thinking I want to say maybe 100 yards, maybe 200 yards out and back. At a football field, something like that. I want to say it maybe 100 yards out and 100 yards back. It was quite a swim for an 11-year-old kid at that time. By the time you got the mill to the buoy, you had to stay there and rest. I was pretty well winded. I mean, even though I knew how to swim, I could, you know, float on my back and kind of rest. You know, I could take my time. I could float pretty much all day. So it wasn't that big of a deal to try to swim straight through. It was kind of a wind. By the time you get out there, you have to hang on that thing for a little while before you start back. So by the time Paul get out there, and he's hanging on the thing. I get there about a couple of minutes later. He's been there for 5 minutes, so he take off and start back to shore. So I'm hanging out there and just catching my breath a little bit. It wasn't really winded or anything. Plus, I could swim a little bit. And one of my neighbors, I start back to the dock. You know, it's just 300 people out there in that lake that day. You know, me out there on that buoy, Paul swimming back. I start back and I see one of my neighbors, Tootsie. His name is James Huffman. We used to call him Tootsie. He's on his way out there. I'm about 10, I just left the buoy there, and I'm about 10 yards from it, and he was scuffing like crazy, pulling himself through the water there, and about 10 yards from the buoy, the last thing he said was, "How far am I from the buoy?" You know, and I told him he was right away, but about 10 more, I told him, I kind of looked around, I said, "You're almost here, you're right there." And he was almost out of breath, and he was struggling. And I realize now, just looking back at it, that he was trying to just pull himself through the water, wasn't using his feet or anything to propel himself. And he was just about out of breath. He was scuffling. And sure enough, he had the strangest look on his—he had a look of desperation on his face. But, you know, I thought he was going to get to that buoy because he was right at it and just hang there for a while until he got his breath before he started back. So I turned around and continued to the dock. I didn't look back at him until I got to the dock. And then to my I got to the dock and I found just about it. Pulled myself up on the dock, then everybody was looking in dismay out toward the buoy. And I turned around, and last thing I seen was a Tootsie jump, bob up in the water and go down under. And he never came back up. He drowned that day. Tootsie was like 14, 15 years old, just had a. But I was the last person to have any kind of contact, hear anything out of his mouth when he asked me how much further that buoy was, and just a wrenching type of ordeal there. He died. He was one of the favorite people in the whole town, in the school and stuff. A big had a real outgoing personality. Everybody was crazy about him, and it just kind of broke that whole town up. He drowned right there in front of 300 people there. Just he went down and never came back up. By the time the lifeguard got out there to him, that lake was deep out there. It took them some 6 hours. They had to bring in the emergency people to go down and get him, and it took something like 6 hours for them to search that lake to pull him out of there. But that broke that whole town up. And Lake Hen, that's 1956, Lake Hen was never the same to swim in again, but I always had that, I always carried that in my psyche there, that I was the last one to share any kind of thing with him. And that was 1946, the death of one of my friends there, a neighbor that upset the town. And Lake Hen was never the same to swim in. In fact, I think they closed it for the rest of that summer, and then the next years and stuff. It was just never the same. Was never the same fun gathering place to swim and to this day. 1956. Okay, I'm moving right along now because it's coming up on time for me to get into a junior high school and stuff like that. And I really started playing some pretty good sports and stuff, and had just a great time in junior high school. Got to high school, 10th grade, my father had Akron. And so this really kind of screwed me around, because I was a pretty good athlete in Barberton, and all the coaches knew me from about the fifth grade on up to high school there. But when I moved to Akron, I transferred to South High School. It was at the South High School no more than 2 or 3 weeks. But and I decided I couldn't stay over there because there was too many folks on the football team and the basketball team. Not only a lot of them was better than me, but they knew the coaches a lot better than me, and the coaches was more familiar with them, so that was going to mess me up. And besides that, so I decided to go back to Barberton. But what that did for me, to live with my brother, by the way, but what that did was it it made me ineligible to play a varsity sport in Barberton. It just messed my whole thing up. I would have been starting as a sophomore if I was eligible, but it made me ineligible for the sports there, and I kind of lost interest in school. So I wound up skipping class and all kinds of stuff my sophomore year. And then my junior year, I moved in with my brother in Akron, and I wound up going to Garfield from my 11th grade there, and I wound up dropping out after that, going to the Marine Corps. Okay, so we're up to 1963. I'm at Garfield High School, 11th grade there, and I'm living with my older brother Woody and his family, and I'm coming up on 18. Turned 18 in February of 1963, and I said, it's time for me to get on my own anyway. I wasn't dumb. I decided to quit school in 11th grade there. I wasn't dumb. I was on honor roll, I guess, to my last report card. So I wasn't about doing the work, but that's what I need to get out of here, because my brother got a family. He got 3 or 4 kids by that time, and I'm hanging around here. You know, my father lived over there, but I didn't want that school where my father was living, so I stayed with my brother to get to Garfield. And I just found that's what I got sick of the whole thing. So here come February 12th, 1963. I'll never forget. I turned 18 and I decided to join the Marine Corps. Didn't want to have to sign for me anything when you turn 18. And especially the Vietnam War was on the horizon then. Wasn't going on, but it was on the horizon. In fact, they did have folks in Vietnam in 1963, but the war hadn't really developed to the point that it would. But anyway, so I go down to the recruiter's office there and sign up. I'm 18. I have the recruiter's got to take me from Akron, and we're living in Akron, but he's got to come pick me up and take me up to Cleveland to get inducted in, because that's where the induction center was at. So he come pick me up at on February the 12th, 1963. It was 19 below zero at 4 o'clock in the morning. It was 19 below zero, not wind chill. This was the actual temperature on the thermometer. And I thought when he blew his horn about 4 o'clock outside, everybody was asleep but me, because I knew he was coming. But my brother and they fell asleep. They didn't know. So I was listening up. I woke up and got up and cleaned up and stuff. And as soon as he hit the horn, I knew it was him. But I opened that door and I thought twice, is this the right thing to be doing at 19 below zero? But, yeah, sure enough, he got me in the car and went on up to Cleveland there, and I joined. And by the time that ordeal ended, it was a couple of days later, I was at in Beaufort, South Carolina, Parris Island. Boot camp in the Marine Corps. That whole other world is whole other environment here. Now remember, I'm a little country boy from Georgia. Starting out, went to another little town in Ohio, which was a little small country town too, but just up north. So I get to Parris Island. I'm back in the South again, first of all, and immediately this racist thing kind of sets in my psyche. It just automatically creeped back in. So I'm back down in the South there in 1963 at Parris Island there. But then again, my horizons was broadened because I meet all these new people from New York, from Chicago, from Detroit, and so I got a whole another set of a perspective to look at here. These folks from New York, boy, you talking about some fast folks there. First time I've been around folks from a big city like that who had experienced a life in the big city like that, and they had all kinds of stuff for me, boy. But really, really got a real diverse mixture of Americans there in the Marine Corps. Really, really enjoyed the 4 years that I was there in the Marine Corps. Didn't have any intent of staying there, but then after I got wounded, as coming up on that, I didn't have a choice, but I really enjoyed the Marine Corps. It gave me an opportunity to travel, to see a world, and for a person in my position that have any other means to do that, it was really a great a place. So 1963, I'm at Parris Island. Finished a boot camp and go to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Partake in a couple of mid cruises there. My first couple of years, 63 to 65. Go to Europe a couple of times, Italy, Spain, a lot of the Mediterranean cities there, and really enjoyed that. Then come 65 here, the Vietnam War was right around the horizon, and we thought pretty sure that we were going to have to be going over there in 65, but it's early 65 now. But just so happened in January of 65, I'm still at Lejeune, but they sent us up to Camp Drum, New York, for cold weather training. Now, okay, we go up to cold weather training up there in Camp Drum. There's one of these other 15 below zero with the wind blowing 10 20 miles an hour, about 40 below zero wind chill factor. So I'm up there for 3 weeks. So, wow, this is crazy. Of course, 6 months later, I would be in Vietnam where it's 95 degrees that, and the cold weather training seemed for naught. But here come around July of 65 now. I've been at in Marine Corps 2 years now. It's time for me to change duty stations there. So I've already got orders to go to Great Lakes to do some guard duty for the last 2 years there. I'm going to be on got me a little gravy a job here for the last 2 years of my service there. Sure enough, Vietnam get hot and heavy. They cancel all the orders and send everybody to Vietnam. I was in 2-8 H&S Company, 2nd Battalion, 8th Marines there at Lejeune. They sent that whole battalion to Vietnam, and me included. So not only did I not go to the Great Lakes, I wound up going to Camp Pendleton, training for 6 weeks to go to Vietnam, and wound up hitting Vietnam about September, October of 65. And from that point on, things would be somewhat different. I mean, we're in a war for the first time, and that whole thing there, that whole war experience, was just that an experience. First of all, when we got to Vietnam, in 65, I guess it was about the 1st of October by the time I got off the ship. Went over there on an Army transport ship. First time I ever been on an Army ship. Didn't even know the Army had ships. They do have troop carriers, transport ships, and we went there on that thing. And it wasn't in Atlanta at Da Nang. Marine Corps, Da Nang, about the center of South Vietnam and north is where the Marines operated at. The Army was somewhat south of Da Nang, from Saigon up to Da Nang. But then the Marine Corps took over, went from Da Nang all the way to the DMZ. So we landed in there, went into Da Nang around July, and kind of guarded that airfield for about, I'd say about the first 2 months that I was there in country. And what an experience, because for the first 2 months, I didn't get 2 hours sleep a night. I mean, it was constant. The ships offshore was bombing the air, terrain around the air base, and the heavy mortars inland was firing all night. It seemed like every time a rocket or a heavy gun go off, you wake up. I couldn't get no sleep. I mean, it was just you're on tense because you're not used to the combat situation anyway. Not you know, when you first jump in there, and this stuff was showing a combat. I mean, I don't think I'm trying to think. It wasn't too many days. From the almost 11 months that I was there, it was very few days that I didn't either shoot at somebody or somebody shot at me for the whole time that I was there. I mean, just constant. It was constant conflict. And so, but war, just like anything else, you as vicious and as violent as it can be, you get used to it. It's crazy, but you will get used to it, and I did to a certain extent. Now, you're always on edge. You're always on edge, but about 2 months went by, and I found myself able to sleep. You know, right through the shooting, you can be shooting, them, but you know, you can sleep 3 or 4 hours at a time, and as you became more accustomed to it, the longer and the easier it was for you to get some rest. It's still, you know, it's a violent situation. Here come around January of 1966. Now, we're still up there. We done left Da Nang because we're heading north. We heading right to the DMZ to confront the North Vietnamese. So we marching. We get on a helicopter. He might take us out on a operation there and come back. But we heading north. We headed north. That whole I get over there, by the way. I'm in 2nd Battalion, Golf Company 4. I'm in Golf Company 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, 3rd Marine Division was my outfit. So I'm in Golf 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines. That's 2-4, that battalion. That's my outfit. Around March of that year, I made Lance Corporal and got promoted to fire team leader. Have been over there about, let's see, I've been over there about 4 or 5 months at that time, something there, about 4 months, 4 or 5 months. So I made Lance Corporal and got promoted to fire team leader by attrition, more than anything else. People dying, getting killed and rotating out of the country. So I got to be a fire team leader. But before I took over my fire team, I go to Okinawa on R&R because I've been there about 5 or 6 months, so I was there long enough to get a week's R&R, rest and relaxation there, away from the combat. And by that, you been over there 6 months, you ready to get out of there. You ready to get out of there in a big way for any amount of arrest. And so, sure enough, I wound up going to Okinawa for a week. This was before I've been promoted to fire team leader, but I don't have any fire team yet because, first of all, we don't have enough folks to fill up my fire team. So I go to Okinawa and run into an old friend of mine, Robert Burks, who was from Cleveland. We went in the Marine Corps together. And sure enough, he had got to Vietnam. He was stationed there in Okinawa doing some kind of work. And I think he was running in and out of Vietnam, but he was stationed there in Okinawa. So I caught up with him, and we hung for that week and had a great time. And I messed around and bought a couple of cameras while I was there. First of all, that one, shooting dice, we gambling over there. That's about the only thing you can do with your money over there is gambling away. Sure enough, I got hot in a dice game and won about $700-$800 in NPC, this fake money that they pay us in over there. I had two fists full of it, it looked like. So I'm rich. I got about $800. That turned out to be about $800. When I go to Okinawa, I got tons of money. That was a lot of money back then. And so I'm out. And one thing about doing R&R, you don't have to have no curfew. So you got the choice of the action at night. So when everybody else go in, whoever was out there, for whatever reason, I got my pick. And so I'm having a good time there for that week. And I wound up buying a couple of cameras, bought a couple of suits that I never got. Taylor was supposed to send them home, and I never got the suits. But the cameras I took back to Okinawa with me. So I'm there. My week is up. Now I got to go back to the war zone here. I kind of hate it, but I only got 6 more months. I figured I did 6 months already. The last 6 months wouldn't be that bad in Vietnam. I got used to the combat. Pretty much as you can get used to war, and believe me, you don't ever really get used to it. You just become numb from it, and that's what had happened to me at that point. And so I'm back in Vietnam here looking for my new fire team members there. And sure enough, I get two of them. By the time I got back, I got PFC John Carey. A white guy out of Salem, Oregon. He's 19 at the time. And I got PFC Gerald Dawson from Waterbury, Connecticut. He's a black dude. He's 17 years old. Wow, he's 17 years old. I'm 20 myself. I just turned 20. So I got my fire team. I'm a man short, though, because normally you'd have four members in your fire team. So I got I'm a man short because we don't have enough troops yet. I got to wait till another guy come into the unit finish filling out my fire team. So I got these two guys here, John Carey and Gerald Dawson. And I'm Lance Corporal Cameron. I'm the fire team leader there. My first command of any kind. I'm responsible for these guys. And they had just got over there. They had just got to Vietnam there. And I'm right away, I'm their lifeline. You know, everything they do has to come through me. They can't breathe without it coming through me almost. So I'm the fire team leader. You know, then we got the squad leader. Four fire teams in a squad. So I'm the fire team leader. We're around, let's see, March of that year. We haven't got to Hue yet, but we're on our way to Hue. on our way to the DMZ, and Way is quite a bit north of Denain, and so we're on our way to Way Denain. But every day we out in the field, and like I said, shooting at folks, the folks shooting at us, and killing folks, the folks killing us. That whole year I was there, that was all it was about. One of the worst experiences that I've had in terms of man's inhumanity to man, war, is just that to its nth degree, I guess. So I got my new fire team leader. We out and just getting to know each other, trying to. I'm just learning how to command a fire team and how to, when we go on patrols and things, how to rotate them through the various formations, job and stuff like that, going out at night when we camped in on outpost and all of that stuff. So it was quite an experience, too. Just getting to know those guys. They're young, and I'm young, really. I'm 20, turned 21, that's 66. But then Gerald, he's 17. He's nothing but a kid, really. We're trying to run it. Wonder how in the world he get into service so young. I'm still kind of curious about it, but apparently he joined when he was 16 because he had been in about a year. He had been in like the January of 65, I think, was his enlistment date. And I think he was 16 when he enlisted. I really don't know how he got past or even got there. But by the time he got to Vietnam, he still was only 17. He did turn 18 that year. But then around May, we get wind that we're going to be going right up to the DMZ there to engage the North Vietnamese there. And sure enough, about a month later, General Westmoreland come into our area there around Hue to plan this, operate this big operation coming up, Operation Hastings. Wow, that's General Westmoreland. We set up camp. He came out and interviewed the troops and, you know, just said the hello to everybody. But he was there to talk to the commanders to plan this Operation Hastings that was coming up. One of the biggest operations they had planned up to that date. The operation, Operation Hastings, you can Google it on the internet. Stay around, wait there for a couple of weeks there, and they get all this, the planning done. And sure enough, July come along, and we embark on this Operation Hastings. That would change some things for me. The operation itself. A combined force of about 12,000 Marines, I think it was something like 8,000 or 9,000 Marines, and about 3,000 or 4,000 South Vietnamese soldiers joined force to partake in this Operation Hastings to engage the North Vietnamese on the DMZ. As it turned out, it was about 12,000 North Vietnamese and about 12,000 Americans battling over this operation. Okay, so anyway, this operation kicks off on July 15th. I'm in G Company, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marine, G Company. Okay, we got three companies operating on this out of the 2nd Battalion, 2-4. That's K Company, G Company, and H Company. We had for another company that we left back to guard the perimeter. I believe it was I Company. I'm looking at it right now. But K Company in the Quezon River, we sits right in the middle of Quang Tri Providence. It's a valley right on the DMZ. Quang Tri Providence is where most of Operation Hastings took place, in Quang Tri Providence. It's right at the foot of the DMZ. That's the militarized zone that's dividing North Vietnamese and South Vietnam, North Vietnam and South Vietnam. Okay, the DMZ. So we had got intelligence let us know that the North Vietnamese had infiltrated the DMZ. They was shifting the troops down through that DMZ into the South, causing havoc there in the Quang Tri Providence. In fact, a lot of the Providence there was sympathetic to the North because they had been fighting the French there since 1954. So a lot of them had was fighting the French in 1954. I guess the whole country of Vietnam was, but then after they ran the French out of there in 1954, they kind of split up into two different segments. That's where South and North Vietnam first split up after 1954, after the French got out of there. But anyway, so they had a foothold there in that Quang Tri Providence already, but we were going to go there and cut that access off to them, that route through the DMZ there in this valley. The Khe Sanh River there is, if you look at my book again, the picture, the upper picture in the right has a picture of Marines in that Khe Sanh River. That's my battalion. That my fire team and my squad led them down that river that morning when that picture was taken. Okay, so we fly up there. What we're gonna do? We got about 2,000 to 2,500 troops. We're gonna put right at the foot of the DMZ on that river. And we're going to put K Company with about 2,000 more troops about 3 miles further west down the river there in that valley. And we're going to H Company and G Company, my company and H Company was working together, by the way. We're going to push, sweep down that river, those 3 miles, to meet up with K Company to trap the North Vietnamese that had infiltrated down through the South there, and wipe them out and push them back across the DMZ and secure that Quang Tri Providence there to run them out of there. So that Operation Hastings, that's what it was about. So they dropped K Company down there, dropped G Company and H Company right at the DMZ. We sweeping down to meet up with K Company, killing everything clean in between the North Vietnamese. But okay, so we start out on the 15th. They drop us out about 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. It's still dark when that thing starts. But on the 15th, when the operation jump off, we making very little progress down through the jungles. Like, this is thicket here. It's 95 degrees and just thick jungle on both sides of the river. So we walking a lot in the river, and where we could, we come up out of that river and cut paths down beside of it. But that was brutal. Every once in a while, you'd run into a path, by the way, where the locals would be using that river and made paths throughout the countryside there. But for the most part, we had to cut our way through that. And the first day, we kind of got bogged down. We must have traveled all of about a half a mile or so in about 3 or 4 hours, and we just kind of really got bogged down there. Had sporadic gunfire, but nothing really major jumped off there. On the 15th, on the first day of the thing, we just got tired from exhausting, cutting our way through the jungle and stuff. So the company commander decided to camp out that day and then start back the next morning. In the meantime, Company K, about 3 miles downriver, was catching holy hell that the 15th. They had been attacked, and all kind of bloodshed broke out then. But then come the 16th, first of all, when we camped out on the 15th, we kind of came up out of the river and went, 200 or 300 yards up the side of the mountain there and camped out in kind of high ground so that we could kind of look down at the river there. But the next morning we got up about 4 o'clock on the 16th and started back down to the river there. And that's where it got to be interesting because on the 16th when we got up, G Company took the lead. We took the lead when we remember G Company and H Company was camped together. They was camped out together that night of the 15th, and we were sweeping that the river. We were sweep in a westward direction down that river together the next morning. So we get up, but G Company, my company, was the first company to hit the Quezon River that morning. That we got there first about 8:30, and a friend of mine, Lance Corporal Flowers from Baltimore, Maryland. His fire team had the point, and my fire team was I was in the second squad there. His squad and his fire team had the – so by the time they got to the lake down there, about 8:30 that morning on the 16th, they'd run up on two naked North Vietnamese soldiers in the water washing up. And sure enough, they wound up being outposts. And when they looked up and seen the Marines coming down through the thicket there, they headed for their rifles, which was on shore. And sure enough, our fire team, our squad, opened up on them and killed them. Kill those two, kept their rifles, and sure enough, any time any shooting go like that, everything stopped. Everybody dropped to the ground and started returning fire wherever they could see it at. But just so happened, it was enclosed there, so maybe 15, 20, 30 shots was fired, and we all dug in and kind of listened to see if there's any incoming fire. Sure enough, there was no incoming fire, so scout that area for about the next 30 minutes or so, and by that time H Company had got to the river and proceeded across the river. So we was going to sweep down both sides of that river, trapping all the North Vietnamese in between us and K Company, which was about 3 miles on further down. We was going to sweep down there and clean out that area. This is Quang Tri Providence, right on the DMZ there in 66. This is Operation Hastings, the biggest operation over there up until that time, involving about 24,000 troops, both North and U.S. Troops there. So it was a humongous operation there. So anyway, after we came up on the two North Vietnamese, sure enough, they were outposts, pretty much like the point. So we there for 35 minutes or so. We start back out sweeping. My fire team with PFC John Carey and PFC Gerald Dawson and me, we've got to point. Of the 2,000 troops sweeping out there, G Company, H Company supporting personnel, it's about 2,000 people. We on the point. The point is much like the a trigger. We're about 100, 150 yards in front of everybody. The point for edification is like a tripwire. If there's anything, if you're going to be ambushed or anything like that, that point is going to catch all of that, and it's going to warn the rest of the troops that there's danger up here ahead, and you better be hitting cover. So that point is like a sacrificial lamb, for the benefit of the many, sacrificing the few for the benefit of the many. That's what that point is. It's a dangerous type thing, but it's a necessary thing because it can wind up saving a lot of folks' lives. It might kill a few folks. So anyway, my fire team's got the point. We start out. I rotate them through. I take the point sometime. I give John the point and Gerald the point. Just depends how long we walk. You know, we get into it about 9:30, and then here come about 10:30. I got John on the point. John Carey, white guy. He's about remember my fire team is still about 100 yards in front of everybody. But I've got and we spread out in a single point. You know, we ain't in no parallel thing, just three man fire team. We're in a single parallel line. PLC carrier is about 35 yards in front of PLC Dawson, and about 35 yards behind PLC Dawson, and we walking down that river. Sure enough, about 10:30, John come up on out the river into a clearing in the side of the dense there. It's about a 50 yard clearing, around about 35 by 50 yard clearing there. Some kind of not sure what went on there, but looked like they may have had some kind of activity there to clear that space out. So John come up and hit that clearing. Now PC Dawson is about 25-30 yards behind him, but anyway, PLC Carey get about 30 yards into the clearing, and all hell break loose. Boom, 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 boom. He gets shot. He's in the middle of the clearing now. Remember, everybody else behind him still down in the river or in the thicket. Can't nobody see him but PLC Dawson, which had just got to the clearing, to the top of the clearing there, and he's looking out. At PLC Carey gets shot. He holler back, Lance Corporal Cameron, John has been shot. And I holler back to the sergeant, which is about 30, 40 yards behind me. He's keeping contact with me. That's the only way we keep contact with each other. I'm looking at the squad leader, about 35. I holler back to him, got a man down. Okay, remember now, once that shooting starts, all hell broke loose. It never stopped again that day while I was there. So Sergeant Hollaback, can you get to him? Everybody had hit the ground by then. Everybody's shooting by then, by the way. Some 2,000 folks that hit the deck and starting to dig in and trying to spot where the fire is coming from, because the North Vietnamese has dug in on the north side of the mountain there and got is shooting down at us. We down in the river. Remember, we down in the valley and got pit down there. Pretty good. Okay, so I said, well, I don't know. I sent PLC Dawson. Can you get to him? He started immediately out to on his way to assist PLC Carey. And by the time I moved up to the clearing by this time too, by the way. And we all shoot and try to turn fire looking up on the side of the mountains, because every once in a while you can see the rifle flashing. That's about the only way you can really spot the enemy there, because they dug in, but you can see the darn rifle flashing. So we return and fire. Everybody shooting by this time. It sounds like 10,000 folks out there shooting. I mean, it literally was almost. PLC Dawson, he starts out there in the middle. As soon as he gets to PLC Dawson, who's been shot, as soon as he reaches PLC Carey, who's been shot multiple times by then, as soon as he lifts him up, he gets shot. I'm looking at it. I'm looking at the scene now, because I can see the clearing, and I'm still right at the top of the river there. I just came out. I'm wet and hot, and everybody's shooting. And PLC Dawson gets shot. Boom, 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 boom. Because they ran in the open. They had only somebody in the clearing, per se, and everybody's shooting at him. He gets shot. Boom, 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 boom. He's holding PLC Carey in his arm. He lay him down. He kind of claps over, and I holler back in the sergeant. Sergeant, I got another man shot. And sorry, can you get to him? I'm the next one. I started crawling out there then. You know, I'm really excited now, because I'm shooting and crawling. I got to crawl because I'm crawling out in this open field and everybody's shooting over me. H Company is on the other side of the river. They shooting a back across the river, a back across me up in the mountains there, and the North Vietnamese is shooting down at me. So everybody shooting at me and my three friends out there in that open field. They shooting over us and at us. So the funny thing, I'm crawling out there. I mean, it's about 35 yards to reach my two friends. And as I'm going out there, I could just see the lid hitting the leaves in front of my eyes, and so happy. I don't know how they missed me going out. Every once in a while I'll raise up and try to shoot a little bit, but then I'm dropping back down. By the time I got to PLC Dawson, I'm out of bullets. I done used 5 magazines. I'm out of bullets and everything else. So I get to PLC Dawson. I've been watching them absorb bullets. Their bodies bouncing off the ground as I'm crawling out there. I'm sure they both dead by now. So I get out there and kind of lift PLC Dawson and sliced over a John. I kind of picked PLC Dawson up and turned him around and got him held up in my arms there. And sure enough, he opened his eyes with the strangest look in his face. I thought he was dead. I didn't realize. I said, Gerald, how are you? And he was telling me, I can't move. He said, I've been hit several times, but the last one hit me right in the back, and I can't move. I can't get up on my raft. I can't do anything, you know. And last words out of his mouth was, Jim, you better get out of here. He kind of just went on it. But by that time, as soon as he said, I better get out of there, I got shot in the back. Boom, boom. Shot once. The right lung collapsed. Took a breath like that. I said, oh, God, what in the world's going on here? And the first words out of my mouth was, God help me. It's first words out of my mouth. When I got hit the first time, I'm still holding John in my arms there. And God help me. And the only thing I knew, because I'd have, and I said the Lord's Prayer, Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give me this day my daily bread. Forgive me my debts as I forgive my debtors. Leave me not in temptation, but deliver me from evil. Thine is the kingdom, the power, the glory, forever. Amen. I started repeating that Lord's Prayer. It's the only prayer I knew. I started repeating it time and time again. But in that time, when I got a shot, went to take that breath of air. It's the strangest feeling. I don't know if anyone's been shot through the lungs and had their lungs collapse. And you kind of take a breath of air, and you only get about half of a lung of air. You kind of get excited. And I said, oh, my goodness. And I kind of really just kind of blanked out there for about a second or so that you hear folks describe of an event like that when your life kind of flashes before your face. And sure enough, it happened to me. I kind of, my body, my spirit kind of left my body there briefly, and I kind of really owned my whole life history. I mean, from day one up to that point. And kind of during this little period, had the strangest little epiphany where I've got these two dead friends of mine literally in my arms. I mean, PLC Dawson's still in my arms, and John Kerry laying under us, a white guy and a black guy. But somehow, while my spirit was going through this little change here, we kind of combined in the craziest way that that would forever kind of change me. For the briefest moment, my spirit connected with John Kerry's and Gerald Dawson's spirit outside of our bodies. Those two was dead, and somehow my spirit connected with those, kind of formed some kind of a key that really opened up some things at that moment. But that euphoria, and it was some kind of euphoria that it took me 40-some years to come to grips with. But in that brief moment, I thought I was on my way to meet God Almighty himself, and really felt as though I had the key to that. What brought me out of that euphoria was a second shot to the back. So, and I still got my friend in my arms there, and I get shot again in the back, and I came out of it. I said, oh, and still, everybody's shooting still. everybody's shooting at us, at each other, and we're still out in the open there in the field. And I come back to my senses, and I said, "Oh God, I got to get the heck out of here. I got to get on the move, because the easiest thing to hit is a stationary target. You know, it's a little harder to hit the moving target." So I put my friend John down. Gerald, laid him down. He had closed his eyes. I laid him down. I said, "I got to crawl back." But I'm shot twice in the back, and I'm losing air and blood at this point. I got very little energy. I got crawled back about 35 yards or so to the edge of the lake there, because everybody's pinned down and shooting. And I started back crawling, and I still got my rifle, but I ain't got no bullets. It couldn't even shoot if I had them, because I'm getting weak now. I'm crawling back, so I start back to the edge of the lake there, get about 5-10 yards, and shot again in the leg. Boom! I'm shot 3 times now. I'm really messed up. You know, I can't crawl hardly. I ain't got too much air, so I'm still scuffling here. I'm trying to keep my head down, and I'm pulling myself along here. And I get about 10 yards from the cover, and sure enough, the sergeant had sent out a couple more Marines to assist me, trying to pull me back in there. About 10 yards, the first Marine get to me and reached down and grabbed me to pull me and help me along there. He gets shot. Boom, 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 boom. And so we got 4 members of the fire team on squad shot there. Okay, so he's shot, and he stayed there. He don't move. And I kind of continued on, because I got another guy about 2 yards behind me. He grabbed me about 5 yards in. He gets shot. Boom, 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 boom. And I get shot again in the right arm. So I'm shot. I'm shot 4 times down the leg, twice in the back, and about 5 yards from cover, I get shot 1 more time in the right arm. Boom! Mess up my ulnar nerve and my medium nerve and my right arm. This is about 5 yards, and by then, the corpsman and everybody done rushed to the front. They pulling all the wounded back there, because we got two guys right there about 10 yards out. They wounded. The other two guys out there, my fire team, they just out there in the field still. We can't get to them. They out there just taking, still dead, and still taking more rounds. So the corpsman, they pull me back in behind the lines. So they put, you know, all the wounded, they pull me behind the lines there. And I get back there, and the corpsman's sure, and I start working on me. I'm bleeding all over the place, my arm, my leg, my back. I ain't got no air. I can't breathe. So he shoot me up with morphine. Started putting tourniquets all over me, trying to stop the bleeding the best he could. But then he's giving me a smelling sauce, too, so that I wouldn't pass out. It's better that you stay awoke until you can get back to the field hospital. So this guy, the corpsman, really saved my life. He did a marvelous job. But for the next 4 hours... we couldn't get a helicopter in there. I laid on the ground from 10:30 until after 2 o'clock that afternoon, trying to bleed. And while I was laying there, they shooting down the medevac helicopter. There ain't nothing landing. They got us pinned down in this valley. This valley of the shadow of death is what I came to describe it as, and that's literally pretty much what it was. But then while I was laying there those 4 hours, I got shot again in the left arm. I was so out of it by that time, I don't even remember whether the gunshot wound in the right arm, my lower left arm, it went completely to my arm. I didn't feel a thing. I was so doped up and out of it, I didn't even feel that. And to this day, I really don't know whether that was an enemy bullet or a friendly napalm, because by that time, and what saved our life really was that battalion commander had called in air support. I mean, they was dropping napalm all over the place. And they dropped napalm right on us for about 4 hours, it looked like. And that really wound up saving us that day. And I was just so... so fortunate to get out of there. But during this whole ordeal now, remember, I done crawled. I think I sat five times. I never stopped repeating the Lord's Prayer. It was the only thing that I knew. And as it happened, that kind of was my saving grace, because about 2:30 that afternoon, when they finally got a helicopter in there to evacuate the wounded, I completely passed out as they was loading me on the helicopter, the medevac helicopter. I passed out from just lack of energy and blood loss. And I really didn't have any thought of ever waking up again. I thought for sure I was on my way to see my my maker at that point. But as fate would have it, some 17, 18 hours later, I wake up. Strangest thing, too. Now, they done got me back in this field hospital at that time, and I wake up in this a field hospital with these strange folks looking down at me with white behind white masks and stuff like that. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know if I was in heaven or hell. And I couldn't talk. They was asking me questions. I could hear them mumbling, asking me how I feel and all of this, but I couldn't talk because I was had lost all kinds of blood, and I'm bandaged from head to foot. I'm looking like somebody out of Tupp's tomb with bandages all over me, tubes running everywhere. But I finally, after a couple of 3 hours, I finally, you know, come out from under that. Plus, I'm sedated like crazy. So four or five hours, I'm able to say a few words, you know, and he's telling me that my lungs collapsed. And I finally come to my senses and realize I'm in a field hospital, but terribly messed up there. And the doctors finally got around to telling me that my lungs collapsed, and they got this tube in one side, sucking out the air, trying to get it to expand again. And that should be another day or so. And they had cut my stomach open to do some exploratory surgery and make sure I wasn't doing any bleeding there. So they was just waiting for my lung to expand again. And that was about 24 hours. Well, sure enough, I laid there for another 2 days. They still got the tube in there, and my lung still hadn't expanded yet. And wow, the doctors, I could kind of tell they was starting to get kind of worried, because it should have expanded by then. And they gave it another a day or so, 24 hours or so, and it hadn't expanded then. They was telling me they was going to have to cut my side open to go back there to look and see what was going on, to see what was the obstruction, just why would my lung expanding again. And sure enough, a day or so, and they wound up cutting my side open, and found a bullet lodged in the bottom of my lung, my right lung. And so it was wasn't allowing the air to stay in there, because it had a hole in the bottom of it. But just so happened, the bullet was lodged in there in such a way that while it wouldn't allow air to stay in, it did keep the chest fluid from going in the lung. So it kept me from drowning on my own fluid in a way. But they had to go in there and cut that bullet out and destroy some of my lung in that process. But I laid there in that field hospital for 10 days before they could get me out of there. Because you can't fly on a plane without the tube in your chest. At that time, you couldn't anyway. You could. There was other ways to get you home. You had to send you out to on a ship or something like that to get you back that way, but you couldn't fly. So I wound up laying there some 10 days. They wound up going in there out in the field hospital and doing that surgery, a dangerous surgery when they have to open your whole backside of your chest to repair your lungs and stuff out in the sanitation conditions in that field hospital is not the greatest for that kind of surgery. And a lot of folks develop pneumonia and all kind of other side effects from that. But just what happened, mine went all right the best it could. It saved my life. They got the bullet out, left one bullet in. That second bullet I got still in me today. Some less than a quarter of an inch from my spine, that bullet hit. But I think the man upstairs, God Almighty himself, I was favored that day, and I did make it back. Got back to the Philadelphia Naval Hospital eventually by that August, and I wound up spending the better part of a year in there recuperating from a war injuries to the point today I'm 100% disabled and from that. That's briefly my the Vietnam thing that I spent there from my time I got there until that July 16th when I got wounded. Got two friends died literally in my arms. The little epiphany that I had with my spirit outside of my body joining theirs haunted me literally for years. But, in war, while the events are traumatic at that time, but over time, some of the things kind of fade from memory, although I never remorsed about the death of my friends. I never understood why. I always kind of thought about them when July came around. Every year for 40-some years, I always find myself in kind of a melancholy mood to this day around that time. But I never really had any real remorse about it. Never did understand why. Until some years, took me 40 years to really get back to it and get myself to come to grips with it. After spending a year in the hospital, I write about, I'm rambling along here. I told you I can go pretty long. I didn't think I'd be talking this long. It's almost 20 minutes to 10, yet we haven't taken a break in an hour, so I'm just steady rambling along. A couple of phone calls came in. I never did even get to them. But if they want to call back, I'll try to take another call here. I'm going to take a break in about another 5 minutes. I did want to get to a little about my life at the Philadelphia Naval Hospital, where those folks really did tremendous work in patching me up to get me back to a point where I could rejoin society and just live. My right arm had nerve damage. My back, my right lung was always damaged. So I wound up staying there, but really give and thank the people at the Philadelphia Naval Hospital a lot of credit for the work and their dedication to taking care of the soldiers and Marines of that Vietnam War. They really did an excellent job, and like you hear so many bad stories about the military hospital, they really did a great job in my case. So, when I got out of the Philadelphia Naval Hospital in May 30th, 1967, I'm still young. I wound up getting married to my high school sweetheart that August, and stayed in Philadelphia there for around that area for the next 7-8 years until 74. Wound up transferring back down to Georgia. After, first of all, when I got into military there, I went to Philco Ford Technical Institute to electronics school there, and start working. When I finished that, start working for Control Data Corporation as an electronic technician, and stayed in the computer business for the next 40 years. But then I worked around Philadelphia there from 67 up until about 74. And included in that time, we went to we did go to moved to New Jersey. So we came to Atlanta. What I'm going to do, I'm going to take a break right here. We do got a gentleman back on the phone. We see this call here. We're going to take this call. We'll take a break, and we'll be back with you in about 3 or 4 minutes. So let me get to the caller, and this is again is the Hushmo Black Forum. I am the Hushmo, your host. We're looking at The Water Boy, The Life and Trials of Jimmy C. Cameron. We will be right back at you here in a few. Are you still there?
Yes, sir.
Okay, you're back live here with Brother Brock from Philadelphia again. Go ahead, Brother Brock, ask your question again. He was just talking about race relations in the military today as opposed to what it was then when I was in the 60s. Actually, in the 60s, believe it or not, in Vietnam, while at war, that race issue thing pretty much disappeared. When I was in Vietnam, like I said, I had a white guy die in my arm and had a black guy die in my arm, and the race thing was nil and void. It's just when you get back into this country that you kind of move back into that realm. But in war, war have a way of making just everybody equal in a real crazy way, but in a real way, it was probably and today naturally you don't have the climate that existed when I was a kid 50 years ago. Race relations and everything else has improved a great deal. Although today's climate with the political discourse in the country today, I kind of get a sense that we're kind of drifting apart and have to constantly be on guard for what's going on today with race relations and racism and hate and all that stuff. I feel as though if we let our guards down, it can creep in on it. It would be just a devastating a blow for the country as we try to move through these difficult days that we're experiencing here. But overall, no doubt it's gotten better. I'd say that. Do that kind of answer
you? Yeah, that answers that. What about as far as before, in the 50s or the early, the late 50s, I believe the Voting Act came into play with the people of color, early 60s. And at that time, just like when people in South Africa finally got rid of apartheid and they were able to vote, there were long lines of people of color registering to vote, being ostracized and going through a lot of violence in order to place their vote in the voting polls. They saw it as such an important duty to do. How do you see and feel now, fast forward into the year 2010, 2011, when you see and hear of so many different cities and towns that the population, minority population, people of color, only have maybe 15 or 20% turnout on voting day?
You know, I can't. Personally, I'm always disheartened when I hear numbers like that. But me personally, I've never missed voting of any kind of election since I turned 18. When I was in the country to vote, I've never missed any kind of election of not voting. So I'm a voter religiously, regardless of who the candidates are. Now, I'm a registered Democrat, but I'm not just strictly sold on Democrat candidates. Although I am a Democrat, I'm probably more of an independent if I didn't have to be registered to vote in something. But, yeah, I think it's important for us to vote at every it was such a monumental achievement for us to get voting rights. But really, it should have came in with the 13th Amendment when we were freed there, and the 14th Amendment and all that stuff should have gave us the right to vote. And but with the Jim Crow laws and stuff like that persisted after the Civil War, we found it necessary to, in the 60s, to still be dealing with rights to vote, which we should have already had that right. And so that Voting Rights Act of 1965 is, in my mind, was an unnecessary evil, was a necessary evil that we should have never had to experience. But today, if a person of color or anyone don't exercise their right to vote, I think it's a disgrace. I mean, you almost got to get out and exercise that right. When you see folks in the Middle East and stuff right now dying, trying to just to get that right. So I think it's important. It's something that we definitely have to do.
What obstacles, what poll tax did you experience growing up when you were
okay,
in the South?
Hey, listen, as a kid, when I lived in the South, I didn't vote until I was 18, okay? By the time I was 18, I was in the military. So I never had a voting issue myself personally. My parents did have all kind of crazy rules here in Georgia that prevented them from voting, whether it was poll taxes or all kind of crazy schemes that they had here in Georgia that prevented Americans of African descent from going to the poll. Me, myself, when I got turned 18 and was eligible to vote, I voted and was able to do so.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right.
Yes, sir.
Let's see if we can get another call on here. I'm going to call somebody right on the air live here, see if I can get a hold to them. I see they're in the waiting room right here. Who is this right here? Hello. Can you hear me? That might be your phone number there. Somebody did drop off, look like. They might just be listening here. I must get here and put them back in there. They can listen along here. But yeah, we that took up a little time here. Maybe we can get this caller here. It's the 404 number, 704. Hello, you got the Hushmo Black here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me now?
Can you hear me? Yeah,
yeah.
I can hear you.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead, sir. Who? What's your name?
This is James Beecham.
Mr. Beecham, how are you, sir?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. I just want to chime in on part of that conversation you were having with that individual concerning voting.
Go right ahead, Mr. Beecham.
Yeah, and lack of voting. Yeah, I was very disillusioned with the people of the city of Chicago. They had a very important election going on for mayor, and from what my understanding is that the percentage of black turnout was ridiculously low for the number of people in the city of Chicago.
Wow!
I understand that they were voting pretty predominantly. That's what the census would want to tell you there, because President Obama. I think that was his. I'm not sure it was his Secretary of State or what his job capacity was with Obama, but he left that post to run for the mayor of Chicago, and it seemed that everyone is led to believe that most black people that did vote voted for him, but most people stayed home. So I was really trying to figure out what in the world was the city of Chicago doing when this mayor. Mayorship is one of the most important things in that city, especially when they've gone through the John Daly era.
I kind of said that bit of news, Mr. Beecham, and it really kind of shocked me, too, as to what happened there. But not knowing all of the dynamics, I found it easy to see that Rahm Emanuel had all the money. And normally in our political environment today, money talks, it seems. And you think, I don't know, I'd hate to think someone was paid to stay at home, but money certainly does talk in this political environment. Perhaps that may have came into play in Chicago. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it probably did have a lot to do with it because, you know, one while there, they were trying to keep him off of the ballot because they said he wasn't a resident of Chicago long enough because they've been at the White House for the last year or so. So
right.
I'm sure when he got the judge to side with him, I'm sure there was money involved with that.
absolutely, Mr. Beecham, you bring up a good point there. I won't dare accuse anyone of outright bribing anyone, but it certainly looks suspicious. I'll say that.
Yes. Yeah, very much so, very much so. But yeah, I won't have your time. I know you got other people that want to talk to you. I'm enjoying the show. Keep it going.
Thank you a lot, then. We'll try to get to somebody else, Mr. Beecham. You have a good
one. All right, you do the same.
All right, we're back here. We're running late here. This thing, I was afraid that I wouldn't get through this book here. We got about 5 minutes left in my show here, and what I'm going to do, I'm going to cut this off. I still got some more to go with the water boy. The water boy haven't got interesting yet, believe me. From where we are, I'm just getting out of the Philadelphia hospital. Just got married in 1967. Starting my new life with my wife and my I don't have any kids yet. I'll have my first daughter in 1968, and we haven't got there yet. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to continue look at the water board next week. We're going to conclude it. I've got about three more chapters that I want to cover. That's the most important chapter is chapter, without a doubt, it's going to be my epiphany, chapter 15. I haven't got there yet. My epiphany, then I got reparations to cover in the book. And then the first American, first African American president. So we got about three more chapters that the audience definitely want to get in on. Remember, I told you this started out as an autobiography, kind of morphed into a biography, but then the spiritual epiphany that I had kind of dominated the story, and I haven't got there yet. So you listening audience, you haven't heard the most important part or the most dominating part of the book, and that is my run-in with the man upstairs, Almighty God himself. But we're going to cover that next week. I'm going to start out. We got some other issues to cover next week. We're going to take a look at Conservative Talk Radio and see how that's affecting our community. The first part of next week's show will be the last three chapters of the Water Boy. We'll conclude it and be done with that. So once again, audience, I thank you so much for your time. And this is going to be canned. You can go out there on my website or Facebook or wherever. TheHushboBlack.com is my website, and pull this down. Listen to it at your leisure. Send us a feedback if you want to chime in. But then we're going to be back with you next week to conclude The Water Boy, The Life and Trials of Jimmy C. Cameron. But until then, we're going to kind of break out of this thing here because we've got about 3 minutes to go, and we're going to wrap this thing up. And hopefully you all will be safe this evening. It is Saturday, and you know how we do on Saturday. But go out and have a good time, and hopefully we'll see you next week. This is the Hushmo on the Hushmo Black Forum. Until next week, we'll see you.